I was around people all the time who were talking about New York and the way New York is now versus the way it used to be. And a lot of them were saying, oh, you know, New York used to be so great. It's not good anymore. And, you know, they'd moved here 30 years after I was born here. And so I think I got a little bit defensive and protective of my city. I was like, wait a minute. Is that true? Is it really over now? This is the end of history.
It's Shelf Life, Thornton Wilder and Audre Lorde, two North Stars in the firmament of Ada Calhoun's writing life. The author of the memoir, also a poet, about her father, Peter Schaljar, and the poet Frank O'Hara, Calhoun talks about Wilder's The Bridge of San Luis Rey, Audre Lorde's essay, The Use of the Erotic, and why the time is right for her new novel, Crush, in which a married woman is urged by her husband to explore her suppressed desires. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. President Trump is remembering Senator Lindsey Graham as a great politician and skilled dealmaker in an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press. The South Carolina Republican died last night, age 71, in Washington, D.C. NPR's Eric McDaniel reports.
Trump said he spoke to Graham by phone Saturday night after the senator returned from a trip abroad. He remembered the South Carolinian as a loyal ally who fiercely advocated for the president's agenda, despite an acrimonious 2016 Republican primary fight. Here's Trump speaking to NBC's Kristen Welker this morning.
This man was a great politician. He really got it.
Graham's temporary replacement will be appointed by South Carolina's Republican governor and serve for the rest of the year. A new Republican nominee will be elected in August and will compete for a six-year term in November's general election against Democratic nominee Annie Andrews in the Ruby Red State. Eric McDaniel, NPR News.
Even as the United States and Iran continue to exchange military strikes, President Trump said today on NBC's Meet the Press that the critical Strait of Hormuz is open to commercial traffic. Iran says it's closing off of the strait completely and not allowing any vessels to transit. This after a third round of U.S. airstrikes overnight. Pakistani and Omani officials have urged diplomacy, but as NPR's Emily Fang reports, both the U.S. and Iran say the temporary ceasefire is over.
Pakistan has been an important intermediary in the Iran war, and its deputy foreign minister told Iran's foreign minister to consider, quote, diplomacy remains the only viable path to resolving disputes. On Saturday, Iran also wrapped up talks with Oman on how to manage the Strait of Hormuz. But later, U.S. CENTCOM said it struck more than 100 targets across Iran, and the Sultanate's news agency reported Iranian drones had struck some sites in Oman. Iran's top negotiator Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf wrote on X, quote, "The era of one-sided deals is over." And Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said it had fired on a ship trying to get through the strait. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Democrats in Maine have 2 weeks to select a new candidate for the U.S. Senate race against incumbent Republican Susan Collins. It's considered a must-win for Democrats if they're to gain control of the Senate in the midterms. Maine Democratic Party Executive Director Devin Murphy Anderson says Collins remains vulnerable because of her yes votes to confirm President Trump's nominees to the Supreme Court.
We have a very real situation in this country where women have had their reproductive rights stripped away from them. That is because of Susan Collins' vote to confirm Justice Brett Kavanaugh. She is not escaping that history.
Yesterday, the previous nominee, Graham Platner, officially ended his campaign amid allegations of sexual misconduct, which he denies. A heat wave is expected to cross much of the country this week. Two-thirds of the nation could be impacted by the high temperatures. You're listening to NPR News. A U.S. congressman says he was threatened by Israeli settlers during a recent visit to the occupied West Bank. Ro Khanna, a California Democrat, claims that Israeli soldiers aided the attackers and blocked him from leaving. From Ramallah, Nuha Muzla reports.
Posting on social media after his return to the U.S., Congressman Ro Khanna says what he saw in the West Bank, including attacks on Palestinians and their villages by Israeli settlers, is inhumane.
We need to stand up for human dignity. We need to tell the stories of what's happening to Palestinians and Palestinian Americans in the West Bank. It's just wrong.
Khanna, who's exploring a 2028 presidential run, says he felt helpless for 90 minutes when Israeli soldiers arrived and did not assist him. In a statement, Israel's military told NPR soldiers did not block the congressman's exit. According to the UN, more than 36,000 Palestinians have been displaced in the past 2 years due to Israeli military action and settler violence. For NPR News, I'm Noha Musleh, Ramallah.
Flooding in Missouri has killed one person, and first responders rescued more than 200 children and staff at a summer camp in the central part of the state. As much as 12 inches of rain fell Friday night and Saturday morning, washing away the roads around Camp Tumsock in Lesterville, Missouri. The National Guard used Black Hawk helicopters to rescue the campers and reunite them at a nearby school with their family. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bayer, who believes science is the relentless process of asking questions, testing, and trying again, even when it's not easy. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. This is NPR.
I was around people all the time who were talking about New York and the way New York is now versus the way it used to be. And a lot of them were saying, oh, you know, New York used to be so great. It's not good anymore. And, you know, they'd moved here 30 years after I was born here. And so I think I got a little bit defensive and protective of my city. I was like, wait a minute. Is that true? Is it really over now? This is the end of history. That gave me the impetus to write this book, which took about 3 years.
Hello, and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Anything Ada Calhoun wants to write is well worth reading. Those are the words of the publishing industry Bible, Kirkus, closing out a review of Calhoun's new novel, Crush, in which the author brilliantly explores the raw, all-consuming nature of infatuation. Calhoun is the author of the acclaimed nonfiction book, St. Mark's is Dead, the memoir, also a poet, which follows Calhoun's attempt to complete the unfinished biography of poet Frank O'Hara, originally started by her late father, art critic Peter Shaldal, as well as Why We Can't Sleep, Women's New Midlife Crisis. She is also, I should add, an acclaimed ghostwriter with more than 30 books under her belt. There are a lot of ways to tell a true story, she has written. I like looking for the most generous and interesting ones. We'll talk about that journey from ghostwriter to memoirist to novelist, as well as some of Ada's favourite writing, including Thornton Wilder's The Bridge of San Luis Rey, almost 100 years old, and the poet Audre Lorde's essay, The Use of the Erotic. Ada, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's so nice to be here, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, you're sitting in a study. It's got that lovely sort of burgundy red colour. Is this where you do your writing? Or are we looking at the nucleus of Ada Calhoun world here?
About half the time I'm here and about half the time I'm at the New York Public Library. I have one of those amazing scholars rooms in the main building where you have a little key card and you can sneak upstairs. So that's my favorite place, but this is a close second.
You do love libraries. There's a section in Crush, your new novel, where the protagonist, I think, is in the British Library, and you describe it with such attention to detail. I really felt that I was in there. But more than that, I wanted to be in there. I wanted to be writing a novel in a library, in a great grand library. It's such a romantic image of the writer. Is that true to your life?
It definitely is. I've been in libraries at least a couple times a week, probably since I was four or something. And I think there's something also about like having to look around at that many books and say, like, the world needs another one. I mean, there's such audacity to that. And I think maybe, you know, we need to be brave. We need to be kind of overconfident to think that we have something to say.
I love the idea of audacity. I work in a bookstore, as you know. My day-to-day life is surrounded by books. And often I do wonder to myself, who could possibly bring or dare to bring another book into the world when we're surrounded by so many books yet to read, yet to consume? But there is always something
new to write. You do that in Crush. It opens with a woman in an ostensibly happy marriage who is given license by her husband, Paul, to graduate from sort of innocent crushes on other men to kissing them as she pleases. There are a few small clues to suggest that she's made a lot of sacrifices for her marriage, having only one child, working extra hard to support her feckless husband. But then the narrative takes a plunge into an all-consuming, passionate affair that we know can't end well for her marriage. I love a quote that you have provided by James Salter. There are stories one must tell and years when one must tell them. James Salter being one of the great American writers. That leads me to ask, why was Crush the story you had to tell now?
So, you know, a few years ago, I wrote this book called Why We Can't Sleep About Generation X Women, and I did 200 interviews. And so many of the women that I talked to basically were saying, like, this is unsustainable. I've been working so hard for so long and taking care of everybody, and I kind of wish I could blow it all up. And then the pandemic happened while I was on book tour for that. And my whole screen of my computer became like crying women for like months, right? Because I was doing all these things online. And I had a similar reckoning in my own life where, because of the pandemic, I actually stopped and really thought more about, you know, what do I want? And, you know, why have I been doing so much for other people and really not asking those questions? So, you know, I thought about the people around me who were asking those questions and about myself. And the book became a novel because I wanted to really go to all the places that I saw people going in terms of asking questions about desire and longing as women and you know, and changing their lives as a result.
There's a book at the heart of Crush, a book about polyamory. That's a word that was suddenly everywhere after the pandemic. I remember a very long article in New York Magazine by a woman who had a polyamorous relationship in Brooklyn. People seemed to be talking about it. It was in the air. You suggest in Crush that was a result to some extent of the pandemic, of this sort of claustrophobic period where people were really stuck at home. One of your characters refers to the feeling post-pandemic is like it's 2 a.m. everywhere. Everybody wanted to be out having a good time. And part of having a good time is sex, is relationships, is flirting, is rethinking perhaps the dynamics of our relationships. Was that something that was apparent to you at the height of the pandemic? Were you aware that people were feeling a need to express themselves in those ways?
Yeah, I think so. And I think also everything changed so quickly and it changed so profoundly. So all of these things that seemed intractable were suddenly very tractable, right? So you have to go to the office every day. Well, no, you don't have to do that anymore. You know, kids have to go to school. Nope. Like there were just all these major changes. And I think a lot of people saw that and realized that maybe there were things about their own lives where they were assuming that there was no flexibility to them, and maybe there was, and maybe they could think harder about what they wanted and sort of make something more customized for their own lives. And I think sex was obviously part of that, and romance was part of that.
You conjured an image earlier of women during the pandemic crying into their computers because they were just trying to do everything and realizing that they needed to think about what they wanted. That was a question you asked yourself. I think you said, why am I doing so much for other people? What were some of those things you were doing for other people that you began to feel resentful about?
Well, you know, I want to place a little distance between myself and my narrator, even though there's quite a bit of overlap. I can say that I was doing a lot of caregiving, and I've been, I think, on my third round of going through hospice with a family member. I was not really able in my own life to make it really make sense. And so I think being able to pull a relatively joyful novel out of that felt like a great thing to do with my time.
Crush is also very funny. Is that instinctive for you? Are you by nature someone who sees the comedy in life, or was that something you had to really work at?
Well, you know, I think it all relationships that I have are built around making one another laugh, which I think is really about playing the same game, right? I think there's something very human about connecting with other people over the absurdity of the things around us. So yeah, it's like breathing to me trying to connect with readers or writers who I follow over things that are funny.
I wonder if we can talk a little about your childhood. You grew up in New York in the East Village. Yes. So very bohemian. Your mother was a stand-up, a comedian and an actress. Your father, of course, a noted writer, art critic. What was it like to have a childhood in a part of the world that is a byword for lots of people, for a kind of footloose, fancy-free existence?
So I wrote a 400-year history of the East Village called St. Mark's is Dead, and I dedicated it to my parents. I said they're the only people I can imagine who would arrive in the East Village in the mid-1970s and look around and be like, what a great place to raise a kid. Because, of course, it was ridiculous. It was like nobody was picking up trash, and the city was totally out of money, and people were fleeing downtown, and that they were sort of arriving, you know, fresh and excited to start a family is pretty funny to me. And, you know, I grew up in the art world. There was this celebration of brilliance above all, I think. And I do think I rebelled by becoming something of a good girl and a teacher's pet. I was very reliable and very thoughtful. And that was my way, I think, of rebelling against this bohemian ideal. My parents used to joke about giving me bad lessons because I think I was really rather compulsive about never offending anyone, never taking up too much room. There was one point at which I learned what the middle finger was, and I was very, very worried that I was accidentally going to use it. And so I would like sit on my hands because I was so afraid that I was going to flip somebody off by mistake. And then on the bus, which I took alone to school starting when I was 6 years old, again, early 80s New York, I wouldn't never sit down because I was so scared that somebody who needed a seat more than I did would show up and want to sit.
You were a pretty avid reader as a child. What were some of the books that really influenced you at that age?
Oh, gosh, I love Jane Eyre. I remember that was like the first book that I was really small now. I look back and I think like I was reading this giant book. And I think part of it was because I was so proud that I could. And so I read it. I walked around reading it when I was, I don't know how old, I was like 8 or something. I mentioned in Also a Poet, my father giving me Frank O'Hara's Lunch Poems when I was about 8 and how special that felt because he wasn't somebody who gave a lot of presents. And so I thought it was something he really wanted me to have. And it was a special kind of talisman.
Yeah, Frank O'Hara really looms large in your life. Obviously, you've written one book about Frank O'Hara. Tell me what you appreciated in his poetry, how it spoke to you as a child.
He was funny and so smart and so charming and so warm. And that was something that was wonderful about listening to those tapes my father had recorded in the 70s with O'Hara's friends, was confirmation that I hadn't imagined it. He was just a remarkably generous and kind and loving and kind of emotional person. So, and I saw that in the poetry, and also it was all about New York. And so you could walk around the city and see corners that he wrote about and think of the lines. And I always loved that.
You have a complicated relationship, I think it's fair to say, with your father, or you had a complicated relationship with your father. You write in Also a Poet that he didn't buy you Christmas presents, for example. But the effort or the exercise of writing Also a Poet changed some of that feeling a little bit. Was it a cathartic exercise ultimately?
Yes. So writing the book about my father, it was very healing, and it was a way of actually taking all of these very confusing feelings and thoughts and experiences that I'd had as his daughter and trying to make them into something that I thought had value. And it was really good for both of us, I think. And I did not think he was actually going to live to see the book published, but he did immunotherapy. He wound up living for 3 more years. And so he read it and I was really scared. And then he said, the first thing he said was something like, you know, I think this is the best book I ever read. And he was full of praise for it. And that was very hard to come by usually in our relationship. I think it changed everything that we were able to say, everything we had to say to each other while I was working on the book. And that he was able to kind of give me that at the end to say those things. It was the best thing that ever happened to us, frankly.
I wonder in what ways your father haunts the pages of Crush. The protagonist has a complicated relationship with her father also in that novel. Is he a figure that is omnipresent in your writing?
Yeah, I think he loomed large in life and he has loomed large in death. And, you know, I'm sure like the rest of my life, right? I'm going to be working through our time together and our time since. And so, yeah, definitely in the novel, there is a father who dies. And it's part of how at this stage, I'm trying to sort through all of that.
Is writing the way you make sense of your feelings?
Yeah, writing is the way I do just about everything. And so part of it is trying to think through problems, try to understand things. I feel like there's nothing that I've ever written that wasn't trying to solve some problem or other, or try to make sense of something I didn't quite understand. And then I think also the reason I feel like to publish anything is to try to make something for other people out of whatever you've been going through, in the hopes that you'll connect with one person who needs it or who hears it, and you can have that kind of connection with them.
You quote the children's writer, Kate DiCamillo, in Crush. The quote is about the notebook that DiCamillo carries around with her, and she says it's a reminder to pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. I love that quote, and it did prompt me to consider what observations would find their way into the pages of your journals, and how much you rely on them when you're writing fiction or nonfiction.
Well, you would find very little that was legible because my handwriting, which I inherited from my father, is really appalling and most people can't read it at all. So yeah, I carry notebooks around. I like paste things in them and I, you know, try to think through questions. A lot of it's like lists of questions. And I always flip through them when I'm trying to write anything, whether it's an article or, you know, in this case, a novel, to try to find lines that I think are good or scenes that are good or anything that could be useful. The same way that I go through and have stacks of books all over my house. And so I also look through those for things that are helpful. It's part of the stew. And I'm so glad you quoted Kate DiCamillo because I think she's a complete genius. And there is I don't know if you know this letter that she wrote to Matt Pena, who's another children's book author. It was published in Time magazine. And it was about why children's books should be a little sad. I can't get through it without crying. I teach it sometimes. It's like comical because I tear up every single time. I just think it's so brilliant. And it's just about how it's our job to love the world. And she talks about connecting with students that she speaks to at libraries and schools and what they need and they don't need to be told the world is beautiful because they know it's not.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Ada Calhoun. She's the author of the novel Crush. Ada, we were talking there about notebooks and journals and what you might keep in yours. Do you carry one with you at all times? Are you, if you're on the subway in New York or at a bar, are you able to sort of pull it out from your pocket or a bag and jot down a note?
I always use composition notebooks. I have for decades. I have, you know, file cabinets full of them. In complicated times of my life, I go through one probably a month, and then other years, it's like one every 6 months to a year probably. And, you know, I write down things I'm reading, or, you know, random thoughts. And yeah, I find it really useful. I wake up in the middle of the night a lot and I have it by my bed.
Another thing that your protagonist in Crush has in common with your life and your life story is that she is a ghostwriter. I wonder in your long and acclaimed career as a ghostwriter, how you've developed or built up tools to get your subjects to talk to you with candor and honesty, and how much perhaps their notebook keeping, their papers, their letters are an important part of that process.
Well, I'd say every project I've helped on has been totally different. And I was a journalist for 20 years, I think, before I started ever helping people with books. So I'm sure my experience trying to get stories and do interviews didn't hurt. But I think helping people with books, it's really like midwifery, I think. Somebody just asked me yesterday, but what if you don't believe what they're saying or don't believe in what they're trying to talk about? And it's such a foreign idea, because I think it's like, if you're the midwife, do you believe in the baby? No, you're trying to have the person have a good experience of giving birth, and you're going to try to make sure the baby is healthy. And I feel like as a ghostwriter collaborator, that's my job. It's to try to help the person do what they want to do. And yeah, sometimes they bring a lot to it right away. Sometimes they do have full drafts of books, which is great. And sometimes they have nothing, which is great. And you just have to talk about what they want to do. Usually it's a combination where they write some and then they talk some. And then it's just about me trying to assemble it and hand it back to them and listen to what they have to say about how they want it to be different. You can do a book pretty quickly when you're committed to doing it that way, I think.
How does ghostwriting, or how has ghostwriting fed into your own personal writing?
You know, I think it made me so much more aware of structure. Like when you structure 30 books in a few years, you start to see a lot of patterns. And I think something became very intuitive. So somebody was telling me that this novel is like very suspenseful. I think if that's true, that's because I've helped so many people with books that I have this idea of what you're supposed to do in a book to make somebody want to keep reading it.
In Crush, there's a real sort of vertiginous sense of what it's like to fall passionately in love with someone. Very real, very lived. While it is fiction, while you are a writer, you are really having to sort of reach into an experience that you've had, that we've all had, of falling in love. We're very used to sort of coming-of-age novels where people experience love in that way. We're less used to having that articulated and described for people in midlife. Was that a very specific and deliberate on your part?
Yeah. So I think when I was working on my book about Generation X women, there was this sense of duty that was so intense, right? So profound that they had felt like they had to do everything and do it all without help. And so I think like what unlocks that feeling? And what I've seen a lot is it's a crush. It's something that reminds you of who you were maybe at a different time in your life, or who you could have been, or who you are at your best. And, you know, I think that that's something that a crush has the power to do at any age, and for men or for women, for anybody. It doesn't stop just because you get smart enough to know that crushes are dangerous.
The Washington Post Review did make a comparison of sorts with Miranda July's All Fours, sort of begging the question of whether we're in a moment when the romantic needs of women in midlife are being addressed by writers, that there is a need there for that kind of narrative. Is that something you'd concur with?
It is, if people are wanting to read those books. And I certainly do. Like, I want to read books about possibility and excitement, and books that make you feel like the world is bigger and more exciting than maybe you've let yourself think in recent years.
One of the pieces you've chosen to talk about today is an essay by the poet Audre Lorde. The essay is called The Use of the Erotic. I was struck by the fact that the protagonist of Crush recalls being shamed as a slut in middle school. Her quote is, "The social retribution for having succumbed to lust." Audre Lorde, whose essay, as I mentioned, The Use of the Erotic is Power, one of your favorite reads, would, I'm sure, have a lot to say about that. In that essay, she suggests that this kind of policing of women's erotic energy is a function of patriarchy. Tell me why you chose this essay to talk about today, and why it means so much to you.
I think it's the first time I read it was not that long ago. It was a few years ago. And I think I underlined almost every line in it. You know, she says that as women, we've come to distrust that power which arises from our deepest and non-rational knowledge, and about how much information and power you can get out of the erotic. And this is not about physical contact. I think that her expansion of the idea of the erotic is so helpful, I think, especially at midlife, because I think, you know, if we've thought of fertility as the ability to conceive and bear a child, at midlife, does that mean we're no longer creative people or fertile people? You know, somebody I know told me it's not just being able to have a baby that makes you fertile or creative. It's that, and that's something that this essay does so beautifully, is it explains all the ways in which, as women, you know, we can tap into this sense of desire and creativity and generativity, whether it's, you know, writing something or having a child or doing a million other things that are generative in the world. And I think that that's something we need to hear.
Right. And she makes a profound distinction, really, between the sort of pornographic and the erotic. She says the pornographic emphasizes sensation without feeling. And what she's really interested in is feeling, as you say, the sort of capacity for joy. The quote I really liked is, in the way my body stretches to music and opens into response, hearkening to its deepest rhythms, so every level upon which I sense also opens to the erotically satisfying experience, whether it is dancing, building a bookcase, writing a poem, examining an idea. I loved that quote. That was the one I underlined.
Yeah, she has this other line that's, the erotic is a measure between the beginnings of our sense of self and the chaos of our strongest feelings. And I think what summarizes that destabilizing feeling of a crush more, where you're like, this is me and this is also really scary.
Ada, if you have a copy there, I think it would be great to give the listeners a sense of this essay. There's two paragraphs. One of them is quite short. It begins during World War II. Would you read that section for me?
During World War II, we bought sealed plastic packets of white uncolored margarine with a tiny intense pellet of yellow coloring perched like a topaz just inside the clear skin of the bag. We would leave the margarine out for a while to soften, and then we would pinch the little pellet to break it inside the bag, releasing the rich yellowness into the soft, pale mass of margarine. Then, taking it carefully between our fingers, we would knead it gently back and forth over and over until the color had spread throughout the whole pound bag of margarine, thoroughly coloring it. I find the erotic such a kernel within myself. When released from its intense and constrained palate, it flows through and colors my life with a kind of energy that heightens and sensitizes and strengthens all my experience. We've been raised to fear the yes within ourselves, our deepest cravings. But once recognized, those which do not enhance our future lose their power and can be altered. The fear of our desires keeps them suspect and indiscriminately powerful, for to suppress any truth is to give it strength beyond endurance. The fear that we cannot grow beyond whatever distortions we may find within ourselves keeps us docile and loyal and obedient, externally defined, and leads us to accept many facets of our oppression as women.
I love the way she starts there with this bit of biography, really. You know, this margarine we had as kids that was white and you had to add this tablet. I mean, first of all, that's fascinating in itself. Just she understands the value of detail in telling this bigger philosophical point. You're getting a little biography, but what you're really getting is a profound meditation on how the erotic works, can suffuse one's life.
Yeah, and just what a wonderful analogy for the way something like that can spread inside you and make and kind of color every day, right? And make everything seem more alive and more exciting.
How do you think this essay resonates within the context of Crush, the book you've written?
Because it's about the erotic and not the pornographic, I think it is maybe relevant in that, you know, the characters in the book are not trying to have like super sexy lives necessarily, mm-hmm. right? That are about either promiscuity or conquest or anything like that. Nothing against any of those things as pathways. But these characters are, you know, they're kind of nerdy and they love books and they like being good to people and thoughtful and considerate. And also they are super hot for each other and so are trying to figure out what to do. And so they read a lot of books trying to figure it out. And I really like the idea that the pursuit of who you are at your core is a worthwhile thing to do. And so I think this essay is really inspiring.
Hmm. I want to go back now to your career, because in the many biographical details of your life, we find that you were a crime reporter at the New York Post. Must be one of the most sort of thrilling beats a reporter could be on. Tell me how that came about and what you learned from that experience.
Yeah, so I was an arts reporter for a long time, and then I was an editor, and then I was laid off and I wound up ghostwriting and that kind of thing. And then I was looking for like a more day-to-day job, and I knew somebody who worked at the Post, and they hired me. And it was just like all day trying to find details about murders and crimes and calling people, you know, on the worst day of their life often and trying to find out more. I think the good thing for me professionally was that, you know, I was used to calling people and having them really happy to hear from me, right? Because I was like writing for the New York Times, like Arts and Leisure section, or for New York Magazine or whatever, to like profile somebody and their theater company. So they're like, hey, they're very happy to hear and they'll answer anything I ask them. And in this case, you know, you get hung up on a lot and you have to have very sensitive conversations that are very difficult and you have to chase people down. And so for me, it was like an apprenticeship of a kind of writing and reporting I'd never done before. So it was, you know, it was a real education and I think helpful just in like, yeah, not everybody wants to hear from you all the time.
I mean, perhaps also taught you a little about addressing sensitive and difficult subjects with someone who maybe didn't want to engage. How you do that, how you unlock someone is a real tool of the trade, right?
It also was what led to the first real book I did, which was The St. Mark's Is Dead, because I was around people all the time who were talking about New York and the way New York is now versus the way it used to be. And a lot of them were saying, oh, you know, New York used to be so great. It's not good anymore. And, you know, they'd moved here 30 years after I was born here. And so I think I got a little bit defensive and protective of my city. I was like, wait a minute, is that true? Is it really over now? This is the end of history. And so that gave me the impetus to write this book, which took about 3 years.
We are always complaining that places change, and it is the very nature of cities to change. And I think Joan Didion said this a long time ago, but it seems even more appropriate now, that New York was a place not only for the very rich or the very poor, but also for the very young. I wonder if just people as they get older just inevitably feel cynical about what's overtaken the place they live in. But maybe even more importantly, they perhaps can no longer, in the case of New York, afford the city that they came to 20 or 30 years ago.
A big part of leaving, I think, often has to do with money. But I think a big part of dismissing it as no longer good anymore has to do not only with not being able to afford it, although that's probably part of it, but with it not being fun for you anymore, mm-hmm. right? There used to be parties all the time and they'd come up to you on the street and they just drag you to a warehouse party. And I just feel like there's a lack of self-reflection in wondering if the reason they don't do that anymore, people on the street, is because now you're, you know, 45 and you're not 22 and like, you know, whatever, dressed to the nines. So, right. You know, the city changes. Yes. And it has absolutely. And it goes up and down and it definitely gets more expensive in ways that are distressing, but also we change and our appeal for the city changes the way it sees us.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with the writer Ada Calhoun, author of Also a Poet, Frank O'Hara, My Father and Me, and now the novel Crush. We'll be back after this.
Radio Catskill's Summer Fun Drive Pool Party is today, 1 to 5 at the Blue Fox Motel in Narrowsburg. We have everything you need to cool down. Live DJ Jason Tugaw, a cash bar with cold drinks, and a big, beautiful pool. Support public radio in the Catskills at Radio Catskill's Summer Fun Drive Pool Party. 1 to 5
today at the Blue Fox Motel. $20 suggested donation at the door.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Ada Calhoun, the author of the novel Crush. We're talking about The Bridge of San Luis Rey by Thornton Wilder, one of Ada's favorite books. Ada, The Bridge of San Luis Rey was published in 1927. It was Thornton Wilder's second novel. He was young himself. He was barely 30 when it came out. It won the Pulitzer. The first of, I think, three Pulitzer Prizes. The other two were won for his plays. It concerns the lives of five people who perish when a rope bridge in Peru collapses, and it explores fate, love, and divine purpose through the backstories of these five fatalities. Brother Juniper, a devout Franciscan monk, seeks to understand whether their deaths were part of a divine plan or mere chance by investigating their lives. It's told through these interwoven narratives and ultimately suggests that love is the one enduring force in a seemingly indifferent universe. I loved a little factoid I found on Wikipedia that it was quoted by Tony Blair, the UK Prime Minister, at a memorial service for the victims of September the 11th, which I love just for showing the way that literature can resonate down the ages and speak to our lives today. Ada, why did you choose this book?
Well, I read it a few months ago and I became totally obsessed with it, and I gave it to probably a dozen people. And oh, wow. Nobody read it. this is one of these books I'm like just trying to foist off on people. So I feel like I wanted this wider stage to try to convince other people to read it and then also have them not read it. But it is such a weird book. It's so surprising. And I was a huge fan always of Our Town. I just saw the production on Broadway recently, which was so good. And I have the play basically memorized. And I thought, wait a minute, he writes fiction and I've never read it. And so I went and bought this and I was like, do you guys know about this? Like, I feel like it's such a strange, strange book. And as somebody who loves book structures, what a totally bizarre way to structure a book. So it opens with this bridge collapse in 1714 in Peru. And then this guy, the priest is like, okay, this is a perfect way to decide like what the meaning of life is and why God chooses some people and doesn't choose others to die, which is what a wacky concept for a book, first of all. Then it's biographies of all these people who have these fascinating, totally different lives in 1714 Peru. So there's five mini biographies. And then he does all this math. So there's like this section that's basically like their Pokemon, where he ranks them on goodness, piety, and usefulness and tries to come up with a formula for why they died and other people didn't. And then it ends with the most beautiful reflection on love that I think I've ever read. So what a book.
Those closing lines are, wow, they pack a punch. I was so moved when I got there. Did you have a favorite character?
I mean, they're all just so unusual, right? I guess Brother Juniper, like what a wacky idea he had. Do you want me to read the end of part one? It's like a small paragraph.
Yeah, give us a small flavor of the novel.
Some say that we shall never know, and that to the gods we are like the flies that the boys kill on a summer day. And some say, on the contrary, that the very sparrows do not lose a feather that has not been brushed away by the finger of God. Let's see AI come up with this book. This is such an unusual, surprising book in every word. Mm.
The character that really stayed with me, I think, is Donna Maria. She's a sort of Peruvian noblewoman, but obsessively devoted to a daughter who seems to have put a lot of distance between them. She's moved to Spain, but she writes these beautiful letters to her daughter, obsessive letters, and she's not much liked by anyone. And I couldn't really understand why. Were you able to figure that out? I was like, I love this woman. Why is she so sort of despised?
Well, she's very needy and very clingy with the daughter, but then her letters are so beautiful. I just found one line about her from her section. The whole purpose of literature is the notation of the heart, which I thought's really good. And yeah, she says she's become a cult of sorrow, right? So maybe that's why she wasn't so fun. She was really sad. She missed her daughter so much, but she was able to turn it into something.
Ada, we have a short clip from the audiobook of The Bridge of San Luis Rey by Thornton Wilder, read here by Timothy Andreas Pabon. Let's hear it.
Any Spanish schoolboy is required to know today more about Doña María, Marquesa de Montemayor, than Brother Juniper was to discover in years of research. Within a century of her death, her letters had become one of the monuments of Spanish literature, and her life and times have ever since been the object of long studies. But her biographers have erred in one direction as greatly as the Franciscan did in another. They have tried to invest her with a host of graces, to read back into her life and person some of the beauties that abound in her letters, whereas all real knowledge of this wonderful woman must proceed from the act of humiliating her, and of divesting her of all beauties, save one. She was the daughter of a cloth merchant who had acquired the money and the hatred of the Lemians within a stone's throw of the plaza. Her childhood was unhappy. She was ugly. She stuttered. Her mother persecuted her with sarcasms in an effort to arouse some social charms and forced her to go about the town in a veritable harness of jewels. She lived alone, and she thought alone. Many suitors presented themselves, but as long as she could, she fought against the convention of her time and was determined to remain single. There were hysterical scenes with her mother, recriminations, screams, and slamming of doors. At last, at 26, she found herself penned into marriage with a supercilious and ruined nobleman, and the Cathedral of Lima fairly buzzed with the sneers of her guests. Still, she lived alone and thought alone, and when an exquisite daughter was born to her, she fastened upon her an idolatrous love. But little Clara took after her father. She was cold and intellectual. At the age of 8, she was calmly correcting her mother's speech, and presently regarding her with astonishment and repulsion. The frightened mother became meek and obsequious, but she could not prevent herself from persecuting Doña Clara with nervous attention and a fatiguing love. Again there were hysterical recriminations, screams, and slamming of doors. From the offers of marriage that fell to her, Doña Clara deliberately chose the one that required her removal to Spain. So to Spain she went, to that land from which it takes 6 months to receive an answer to one's letter. The leave-taking before so long a voyage became in Peru one of the formal services of the church. The ship was blessed, and as the space widened between the vessel and the beach, both companies knelt and sang a hymn that never failed to sound weak and timid in all that open air. Doña Clara sailed with most admirable composure, leaving her mother to gaze after the bright ship, her hand pressing now her heart and now her mouth.
And that was an excerpt from the audiobook of The Bridge of San Luis Rey by Thornton Wilder. It was read there by Timothy Andreas Pabon. It's available from Blackstone Publishing. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Ada Calhoun. She's the author of the novel Crush. I wonder, in what ways does the novel explore for you the sort of tensions between faith and rationale or reason?
Well, I think the whole book is about what love is and what love does and the power of it and how unruly it is, how it can just take over your life, and that it's the only thing that matters, and it's the most important thing.
That brings us back to Crush, a novel where love is certainly unruly. You make so many references throughout Crush to literature. Were you reading all those other books as you were writing Crush? What was your sort of process there? Or were they books that you had read previously, jotted down things in your journals, and then came back to?
It was a combination, but yeah, mostly it was just things that I've read over the past few years that stuck with me. And whenever I'm working on any book, I bring all my notebooks and then also all the like stacks and stacks of books and just kind of go through them and try to find these pieces. Like I think with nonfiction and fiction, it's always things that might be helpful, like anything that might be relevant or helpful. I just want to throw it all at the question.
Thornton Wilder, as I mentioned, won the Pulitzer 3 times. I do wonder, when you say you gave The Bridge of San Luis Rey to so many friends who seem not to have read it, and it is a slight book, we should add, it's not long, whether he is one of those writers whose novels are, although all still in print, are widely read at all today. I mean, this book is almost 100 years old, but he's so much better known for his plays, particularly Our Town. It seems sort of a slight to his posthumous reputation to ignore his novels.
Well, I mean, I think it's true of so many writers, right? Like there's great essayists whose poetry is really bad. There's novel writers who their nonfiction can never get into. So I don't begrudge my friends not reading every book I give them because I give out a lot of books all the time. And I just actually found a line in the book which speaks to this, which is the abbess was one of those persons who have allowed their lives to be gnawed away because they have fallen in love with an idea several centuries before its appointed appearance in the history of civilization. So, you know, people might not be ready for a resurrection of Thornton Wilder's novels. And also, his plays are so good and so brilliant. How are you going to begrudge anybody preferring those to the fiction?
And what is it about Our Town that speaks to you so much?
It's the only play I ever was in. I was a townsperson and in the choir, and it was, you know, the beginning and end of my acting career. And the rhythm of that play is just, it's so magical. It's so perfectly constructed. And I feel like the build, you don't even feel it coming, right? And then Act 3, I can't make it through Act 3 without crying the whole way. It's so strong and remarkably constructed, like almost like the Mousetrap, but for like existential angst.
Tell me a little about Sob Sisters, which is a sort of literary, performative literary union you've created.
Well, I don't know if I'd say it was performative because it's more like a club, like a club gathering. I started with my friends Susanna Cahalan and Abbott Kaler, and it's women who work in nonfiction in various ways coming together just mainly to help one another. And you know, usually a few people will talk, like somebody will read their new book that's out, and somebody else will talk about a proposal they're trying to write, and they'll be a publicist or a rights manager or an editor or an agent or something. And they just speak for a few minutes and everybody kind of pelts them with questions. And then it just breaks into like a party, basically. And a lot of books have come out now that came out of that world. So I've been seeing it in a lot of acknowledgments for new books, and it's made me really happy.
How important is creating a kind of support group of peers, of friends and other writers, you know, for a writing community?
Somebody who just came for the first time recently said, I thought it was a cult because I walked in and everybody started smiling at me. It's just like it's a very happy, upbeat kind of a scene. And yeah, I think maybe just to bring it back to the novel for a minute, I think part of the point of the book is there are so many different kinds of love, right? And not all of them fit into these neat categories. So you have somebody who maybe is your husband, and you have somebody who's your best friend, and you have somebody who's like your friend that you're pretty close to, but not that close to, who like gives good advice. And you have a pen pal. And I just think there are so many different forms of love, and they're all valuable.
Ada, we talked about your father. We never talked about your mother, or not really. She had a career as a stand-up. She went into film. She was an Urban Cowboy with John Travolta and Deborah Winger. But I'm curious about her stand-up. What was her routine like? Did you ever get to see it, or was this all before you came into the world?
It was all before I came into the world. But when I found the tapes of my father's interviews with Frank O'Hara's friends, I also found a couple of tapes that had her and her accompanist, pianist, best friend on them. And they're just ridiculous. There's one where she does the song Willkommen from Cabaret, but the English translation. So it's just welcome and welcome and welcome. Happy to see you, happy to see you, happy to see you. And she sings the whole thing. It's like totally ridiculous. So, you know, she played all these kind of ditzy, wacky ladies. And it's very funny.
Barbara Stanwyck, I know you're a fan. I love Christmas in Connecticut. What's your favorite Barbara Stanwyck movie?
Oh, the Lady Eve is the best one. Lady Eve is so sexy and so funny. I could watch the movie 1,000 times, and I think have.
It's that sort of New York broad that she's so good at playing. And also the modern woman, as played by Barbara Stanwyck, was such a kind of power force. Like, it just felt that that was a time when Hollywood, at least, was exploring, entertaining, and embracing the idea of sort of powerful, dynamic women.
I think she ages so well in a way that not all of those screwball comedy heroines do. Like, you know, nothing against the other ones, but they just come across as a little frantic. And she is so steady and so gimlet-eyed. And you get the depth and the smartness and the hard-won wisdom. And there's something like really intense about her character sometimes where she's been through a lot, but then she's able to play these like totally hilarious comic roles. She's very versatile.
Let's talk about TV, because I can entirely imagine Crush being made into a TV series. You know, I could see HBO or Netflix swooping in and saying, we want that. Have you entertained any offers yet?
There's been some interest, and I'm always all for it. I feel like everything gets optioned, but I like that idea. I like the idea of narratives out there in any different kind of form that feel authentic and that are asking questions about the way people really live, and that aren't fairy tales the way I think we've seen before, right? Of like where the happy ending is a wedding or a baby, because we know that that's not true if we're adults. It's more complicated.
Have you already started your next project? It seems like you're someone who is never without a project or two.
So I have a few that I'm helping other people with. And then I have like an audio thing I'm trying to do. And then a children's book that I think is actually going to happen, which I'm really happy about because I'm trying to colonize every part of the bookstore and library. So that seems to be happening. And then, and then something else in fiction, something else in nonfiction. So we'll see. You never know what's gonna take off, but I got a few things going.
Ada Calhoun, thank you so much for being a guest on this episode of Shelf Life. I love Crush. I think it's going to be one of the books of summer. It's published by Viking. Ada, thank you.
Thank you so much, Aaron. This was fun.
We've been talking about The Bridge of San Luis Rey, published by Vintage Classics. The essay, The Uses of the Erotic, is included in the collection Sister Outsider, published by Crossing Press. Crush by Ada Calhoun is published by Viking Books. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Gram Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Joyce Maynard, Kevin Barry, Jeanette Winterson, and Alan Cumming. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star review? It will help others find the show.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole, and I hope you're having a great weekend. We're certainly having a big weekend ourselves at Radio Catskill. We're more than halfway to the goal for our summer fun drive, so if you haven't given yet, please give now at wjffradio.org. What else is going on this weekend? Well, we had local musicians performing live on air yesterday for 6 hours, and if you missed any of it, the full video of all the performances is up now at wjffradio.org, which, again, is where you can also donate to support this amazing radio station, wjffradio.org. That video is also up on our YouTube channel. And if you want to help Radio Catskill and don't have anything to donate, go to youtube.com, find Radio Catskill's channel, watch, like, and share our videos, and subscribe to the channel. Help grow our engagement. It's a big way to help, and it doesn't cost a thing. And coming up this afternoon, We are wrapping up our big weekend with a big party at the Blue Fox's Big Old Pool. It's Radio Catskills Pool Party. This afternoon, we've got Jason Tuga spinning tunes, food and drink available, the debut of Radio Catskills' newest t-shirt, and a beautiful pool, perfect for dipping in or lounging by. I hope to see you at the pool party 1 to 5 this afternoon. Suggested donation of $20.